You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in four sections. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to section one. Section one. You will hear a woman phoning a box office to ask about a festival in the town of Kenton. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
Good morning, Kenton Festival Box Office. How can I help you?
Oh, good morning. I'm coming to Kenton for a few days' holiday next month, and a friend told me there's a festival. She gave me this number to find out about it.
That's right. The festival begins on the 16th of May and goes on till the 19th.
Oh, that's great. I'll be there from the 15th till the 19th. So, could you tell me the programme, please?
Well, on the first day, there's the opening ceremony in the town centre. People start gathering around 2 o'clock to get a good place to see from, and the events will start at 2:45 and finish about 5:30.
Okay, thanks. I'll make sure I get there early to get a good spot.
The festival will be officially opened by the mayor. He'll just speak for a few minutes, welcoming everyone to the festival. All the town councillors will be there, and, of course, lots of other people.
Right.
Then there'll be a performance by a band. Most years we have a children's choir, but this year the local army cadets offered to perform, and they're very good.
Uh-huh.
After that, a community group from the town will perform a play they've written themselves. Just a short one. It's about Helen Tungate. I don't know if you've heard of her.
I certainly have. She was a scientist years ago.
That's right. She was born in Kenton exactly 100 years ago, so we're celebrating her centenary.
I'm a biologist, so I've always been interested in her. I didn't realise she came from Kenton.
Yes. Well, all that will take place in the afternoon, and later, as the sun sets, there'll be a firework display. You should go to the park to watch, as you'll get the best view from there. And the display takes place on the opposite side of the river. It's always one of the most popular events in the festival.
Sounds great.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10.
And what's happening on the other days?
There are several events that go on the whole time. For example, the students of the Art College have produced a number of videos all connected with relationships between children and their grandparents.
That sounds interesting. It makes a change from children and parents, doesn't it?
Exactly. Because the Art College is in use for classes throughout the festival, the videos are being shown in Hansworth House.
How do you spell the name?
Hansworth. Hansworth House. It's close to the town hall.
Right.
Now, let me see, what else can I tell you about?
Are there any displays of ballet dancing? I'm particularly interested in that, as I do it as a hobby.
There isn't any ballet, I'm afraid, but there'll be a demonstration of traditional dances from all round the country.
Well, that'd be nice. Where is that being held?
It's in the market in the town centre. The outdoor one, not the covered market. And it's on at 2 and 5 every afternoon of the festival, apart from the first day.
Lovely. I'm interested in all kinds of dancing, so I'm sure I'll enjoy that.
I'm sure you will.
And I'd really like to go to some concerts, if there are any.
Yes, there are several. 3 performed by professionals and 1 by local children.
And where is it being held?
It's in the library, which is in Park Street. On the 18th at 6:30 in the evening.
I presume I'll need tickets for that.
Yes, you can book online or you can buy them when you arrive in Kenton, either at the festival box office or from any shops displaying our logo in the windows.
Well, I think that'll keep me busy for the whole of my stay in Kenton. Thank you so much for all your help.
You're welcome. I hope you enjoy your stay.
Thank you. Goodbye.
That is the end of section 1. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turn to section 2. Section 2. You'll hear a tour guide giving a talk about a museum centre called Riverside Industrial Village. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 13. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 13.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Riverside Industrial Village. To start your visit, I'm just going to give you a brief account of the history of the museum before letting you roam about on your own. I won't keep you long, okay? Now, from where we're standing, you've got a good view of the river over there. And it was because of this fast-flowing water that this site was a natural place for manufacturing works. The water and the availability of raw materials in the area, like minerals and iron ore, and also the abundance of local fuels like coal and firewood, all made this site suitable for industry from a very early time. Water was the main source of power for the early industries, and some of the water wheels were first established in the 12th century, would you believe? At that time, local craftsmen first built an iron forge just behind the village here on the bend in the river. By the 17th and 18th centuries, the region's rivers supported more than 160 water mills, and many of these continued to operate well into the 19th century. But then the steam engine was invented. And then the railways came, and the centres of industry were able to move away from the rivers and the countryside and into the towns. So industrial villages like this one became very rare. So, that's the history for you. If you'd like any more information, you can ask me some questions, or you can read further in our excellent guidebook.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 14 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 14 to 20.
Now, I'm going to give you a plan of the site, and I'd just like to point out where everything is, and then you can take a look at everything for yourself. I've already pointed out the river, which is on the left, and of course, running along the bottom is Woodside Road. Got it? Okay. Now, we're standing at the entrance. See it at the bottom? And immediately to our right is the ticket office. You won't need that, because you've got your group booking. But just past it are the toilets. Always good to know where they are. In front of us is the car park, as you can see. And to the left, by the entry gate, is the gift shop. That's where you can get copies of the guide, like this one here. Now, beyond the car park, all the buildings are arranged in a half circle, with a yard in the middle. The big stone building at the top is the main workshop. That's where the furnace is, and where all the metal was smelted and the tools were cast, as you'll be able to see. Now, in the top right-hand corner, that building with bigger windows is the showroom, where samples of all the tools that were made through the ages are on display. In the top left corner is the grinding shop, where the tools were sharpened and finished. And on one side of that, you can see the engine room, and on the other is the cafe, which isn't an antique, you'll be pleased to know, though they do serve very nice old-fashioned teas. The row of buildings you can see on the left are the cottages. These were built for the workers towards the end of the 18th century, and they're still furnished from that period, so you can get a good idea of ordinary people's living conditions. Across the yard from them, you can see the stables, where the horses were kept for transporting the products. And the separate building in front of them is the works office, and that still has some of the old accounts on display. Right, if anyone wants a guided tour, then I'm starting at the engine room. If you'd like to come along this way, please, ladies and gentlemen.
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Part 3. You will hear two urban planning students discussing bike sharing schemes in different cities. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Now that we've done all the research into bike sharing schemes in cities around the world, we need to think about how we're going to organise our report.
Right. I think we should start by talking about the benefits. I mean, it's great that so many cities have introduced these schemes where anyone can pick up a bike from dozens of different locations and hire it for a few hours. It makes riding a bike very convenient for people.
Yes, but the costs can add up, and that puts people on low incomes off in some places.
I suppose so. But if it means more people in general are cycling rather than driving, then because they're increasing the amount of physical activity they do, it's good for their health.
Okay, but isn't that of less importance? I mean, doesn't the impact of reduced emissions on air pollution have a more significant effect on people's health?
Certainly in some cities, bike sharing has made a big contribution to that, and also helped to cut the number of cars on the road significantly.
Which is the main point.
Exactly. But I'd say it's had less of an impact on noise pollution, because there are still loads of buses and lorries around.
Right.
Shall we quickly discuss the recommendations we're going to make?
In order to ensure bike sharing schemes are successful?
Yes.
Okay. Well, while I think it's nice to have really state-of-the-art bikes with things like GPS, I wouldn't say they're absolutely necessary.
But some technical things are really important, like a fully functional app, so people can make payments and book bikes easily. Places which haven't invested in that have really struggled.
Good point. Some people say there shouldn't be competing companies offering separate bike-sharing schemes, but in some really big cities, competition's beneficial. And anyway, one company might not be able to manage the whole thing.
Right. Deciding how much to invest is a big question. Cities which have opened loads of new bike lanes at the same time as introducing bike-sharing schemes have generally been more successful. But there are examples of successful schemes where this hasn't happened. What does matter, though, is having a big publicity campaign.
Definitely. If people don't know how to use the scheme or don't understand its benefits, they won't use it. People need a lot of persuasion to stop using their cars.
Before you hear the rest of the discussion, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Shall we look at some examples now and say what we think is good or bad about them?
I suppose we should start with Amsterdam, as this was one of the first cities to have a bike-sharing scheme.
Yes, there was already a strong culture of cycling here. In a way, it's strange that there was such a demand for bike-sharing, because you'd have thought most people would have used their own bikes.
And yet it's one of the best-used schemes. Dublin's an interesting example of a success story.
It must be because the public transport system's quite limited.
Not really. There's no underground, but there are trams and a good bus network. I'd say price has a lot to do with it. It's one of the cheapest schemes in Europe to join.
But the buses are really slow. Anyway, the weather certainly can't be a factor.
No, definitely not. The London scheme's been quite successful.
Yes, it's been a really good thing for the city. The bikes are popular and the whole system is well maintained, but it isn't expanding quickly enough.
Basically, not enough's been spent on increasing the number of cycle lanes. Hopefully that'll change.
Yes. Now, what about outside Europe?
Well, bike-sharing schemes have taken off in places like Buenos Aires.
They built a huge network of cycle lanes to support the introduction of the scheme there, didn't they? It attracted huge numbers of cyclists where, previously, there were hardly any.
An example of good planning.
Absolutely. New York is a good example of how not to introduce a scheme. When they launched it, it was more than 10 times the price of most other schemes.
More than it costs to take a taxi. Crazy. I think the organisers lacked vision and ambition there.
I think so too. Sydney would be a good example to use. I would have expected it to have grown pretty quickly here.
Yes. I can't quite work out why it hasn't been an instant success like some of the others. It's a shame, really.
I know. Okay, so now we've thought about all the...
That is the end of part three. You now have half a minute to check your answers to part three.
Now turn to section four. Section four. You will hear a talk about a project on the wildlife found in city gardens in Britain. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Good morning. Today I'd like to present the findings of our Year 2 project on wildlife found in gardens throughout our city. I'll start by saying something about the background to the project, then talk a little bit about our research techniques, and then indicate some of our interim findings. First of all, how did we choose our topic? Well, there are four of us in the group, and one day, while we were discussing a possible focus, two of the group mentioned that they had seen yet more sparrowhawks, one of Britain's most interesting birds of prey, in their own city center gardens, and wondered why they were turning up in these gardens in great numbers. We were all very engaged by the idea of why wild animals would choose to inhabit a city garden. Why is it so popular with wildlife when the countryside itself is becoming less so? The first thing we did was to establish what proportion of the urban land is taken up by private gardens. We estimated that it was about one-fifth, and this was endorsed by looking at large-scale usage maps in the town land survey office, 24% to be precise. Our own informal discussions with neighbors and friends led us to believe that many garden owners had interesting experiences to relate regarding wild animal sightings. So we decided to survey garden owners from different areas of the city. Just over 100 of them completed a survey once every 2 weeks for 12 months, ticking off species they had seen from a pro forma list, and adding the names of any rarer ones. Meanwhile, we were doing our own observations in selected gardens throughout the city. We deliberately chose smaller ones because they were by far the most typical in the city. The whole point of the project was to look at the norm, not the exception. Alongside this primary research on urban gardens, we were studying a lot of books about the decline of wild animals in the countryside and thinking of possible causes for this. So what did we find? Well, so much that I just won't have time to tell you about here. If you're interested in reading our more comprehensive findings, we've produced detailed graphic representations on the college website. And, of course, any of the group would be happy to talk to you about them. Just email us. What we've decided to present today is information about just three species, because we felt these gave a good indication of the processes at work in rural and urban settings as a whole. The first species to generate a lot of interesting information was frogs, and there was a clear pattern here. They proliferate where there is suitable water. Garden ponds are on the increase. Rural ponds are disappearing, leading to massive migration to the towns. Hedgehogs are also finding it easier to live in urban areas, this time because their predators are not finding it quite so attractive to leave their rural environment, so hedgehogs have a better survival rate in cities. We had lots of sightings, so all in all, we had no difficulties with our efforts to count their numbers precisely. Our final species is the finest of bird singers, the song thrush. On the decline in the countryside, They are experiencing a resurgence in urban gardens because these days gardeners are buying lots of different plants, which means there's an extensive range of seeds around, which is what they feed on. Another factor is the provision of nesting places, which is actually better in gardens than the countryside. Hard to believe it, but it's true. Incidentally, we discovered that a massive new survey on song thrushes is about to be launched, so you should keep an eye open for that. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers.